If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
You know, I didn't have to suffer through the real estate problems in 2008 and all that. I'm doing business. Our business is busy all the time. When the real estate market is bad, people accumulate money and they go out and try to buy good buys. And when the real estate market is good, they want in. So we don't see any cycle of the business. We're just doing business all the time. So it's wonderful.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Hey, Gene, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam, good morning. How's everything in Memphis?
Oh, man, we're doing great. We're doing great. And how about you?
No, I'm doing fine. I wish I had some barbecue and some rock and roll this morning. I wish I was with you for a couple days.
So. Oh, man, it would be a good time. I wish you were. Gene, I know a lot of our listeners probably already know your name, but may not know your quick bio. Can you give us just a quick background on who you are?
Three things, all encompassed in real estate, all encompassed in commercial real estate. Came out of college, went into the world of commercial real estate brokerage, did that for maybe 10 years. Then I decided I wanted to buy some properties for myself and started doing that. And like every syndicator we know, Sam, I ran into a property that I couldn't buy by myself. I needed some other people's money, so I put together a group, and that started about a 20-year run in real estate syndication. And then after a period of time there, I realized that I wasn't going to do that for the rest of my life, so I decided at 45 that for the next 15 years that I was going to work, I was going to be an attorney. So at 45, I went to law school so I could be a securities attorney. And that was 27 years ago.
I see how your 15 worked out.
Yeah, but as my wife says, you know, you'll never retire. You have no interests. I said, I sure do. I love to work. So here we go. So everything I've ever done has been in commercial real estate and really focusing on group ownership one way or another.
That is really cool. I mean, that's a heck of a career shift. Right, yep. In the middle. I mean, age 45 is not when people typically decide they're going back to school.
Well, the business was good. And in fact, the year I made a decision that I'd done enough syndication, I had sent out 1,676 K-1s representing over 850 investors. And in those days, there were no companies that provided back office support like there are today. If I'd been syndicating today, and I knew about the back office companies, and there were some, who knows, I might not have changed. But I was not ready to continue to grow with people and space and overhead to continue to support that. And it was just a good time. We had built a bunch of self-storage. That's what I really did. I built self-storage facilities, about 22 of them in Southern California. We built them, got them 50% occupied, and then sold them to long-term hold investors because we weren't in the holding business. We were in the net worth business, when to build our net worth and build something and sell. So it was just the right time. You sat around the kitchen table where all the great decisions in life are made, and we made that decision, and away we go.
Yeah, wow. Now that's amazing. 22 self-storage facilities and 1,676 K-1s. I bet all of those were packaged manually.
Well, I licked envelopes and licked stamps. My whole set, for 3 months, we were basically out of business getting all of the, we had 16 funds and I used three different accountants because I couldn't dump 16 offerings on any one accountant at that time of the year. Three different accountants. And, they got us the K-1s, and then we had to manually process all that. So that just took us out of business really from December to February.
Wow. Wow. And that's crazy because, you know, in this day and time, I mean, it's still a project, but it's not 3 months. It's a couple weeks, maybe.
No. In fact, if I used all my investor communication was like that, because that's all we had, you know, seriously. And you may laugh at this, I'm building storage facilities back then. investors want to know that I'm actually building something, okay? So I'd go out there with camera, take a picture, run down, this tells you how long ago it was, run down to Savon's or something and get 50 prints of the pictures, stuff them in envelopes and send a quarterly port. Yeah, look at this. There's 10 cement trucks backed up because we were doing poured concrete construction. You know, you couldn't just take it on a camera and put it on your Facebook page and show, because there wasn't anything like that then. Right. So communication was just totally different. And got so toward the end, what I did is I put a camera hooked to a website on the project. And so each project had a website address so the people could go to that address and click on and see the guys pouring concrete and the roofs going on and the orange paint being painted. So that was cool.
Wow. Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess that would have been, I don't know when webcams first came out, but late 90s, maybe when we've had our first video capabilities over the internet. Yeah. At what point in time? So it sounds like you had a good thing going. Like you had, you were able to raise capital. You had a niche that you were involved in the industry. You had projects that were going down. You were making money. What about that made you say, I don't want to do this anymore?
Well, here's the deal. There's always the backside. The backside of the story is I was raising money through the broker-dealer community. The broker-dealer community came to me and wanted me to do bigger deals. And all my deals were $5 million raises or less. And I could go to the broker-dealer community for their due diligence on my project. And I could show them that I could fund the deal if their money raising was slower than anticipated. I never have to give anyone their money back. If we were short on the day of closing and construction, I could fund it. That's fine. Well, they came to me and I had a network. I had 16 companies selling for me. And what was happening is the companies that did the due diligence quickly would get to sell something, and the companies that took a while, there wouldn't be anything left to sell. So my number one underwriter came to me and said that if I would do $10 million deals and agree that they would be the only fundraiser, they'd continue to work with me. But they wanted me to prove that I could close the deal, $10 million, and they were only going to sign a best efforts contract with me. And I thought, well, this is a perfect time to quit because I didn't want to. There have been three times in my life where I've had a chance to grow and my headset is no. At some point, that's big enough. And so this was the point of time. So I went home. I had that meeting with the guy in the morning. I went home at lunch, talked to my wife. And that night I was researching how does a 45-year-old guy get into law school? Okay.
It doesn't sound like you regret that decision.
Been a great decision, because this business is constant. It's current. I don't have, I didn't have to suffer through the real estate problems in 2008 and all that. I'm doing business. Our business is busy all the time. When the real estate market is bad, people accumulate money and they go out and try to buy good buys. And when the real estate market is good, they want in. So we don't see any cycle of the business. We're just doing business all the time. So it's wonderful. And it's a clean way of being an attorney. I never go to court. I do paperwork basically, and I mentor and talk to people. So it's an easy deal.
Right, right. That's fascinating. It's interesting that you had that runway almost. I mean, other than maybe some of the terms that they were offering you weren't the best. But you had that runway in front of you to go do much bigger deals and to really, and you, most of us, especially the overachievers in us, are never satisfied. There's never enough. And so.
Oh, I was plenty satisfied. And once again, there was no support. The only support I would have had would have been to hire more people,
right,
and get a bigger office space and more overhead. And I didn't need that. Plus, whether I had the $10 million available at one time, I wasn't willing to take that risk. Right. Five was okay. I could walk into them and say, here's my assets. Here's what I can do. Here's my liquid cash. We can close this deal. Fine. They'd sign the document, start selling it. I never had to use my full $5 million. I had to use $1.5 million once, but that was only for 30, 45 days. So it's fine. So anyhow, that's my background. And all that background, Sam, makes me an ideal person for a client, because that just hasn't been, what did you learn in law school? Now, how did you go to work and learn how to draft a document and do this? I was in the fields. I was in the business. So I can mentor pretty well and I can understand. And I have a special affinity to first-time syndicators, Sam. In fact, every month we do in our firm a rookie training camp. It's online. It's 15 people maximum, 2 3-hour sessions in the same week online, and you can't come if you're not a rookie. And so I'm trying to continue to build my business now with new people, because we have plenty of existing clients. But if this thing is going to outlive me, this firm is going to outlive me and support the people that are with me today, we need to continue to generate new business. And so my rookie camp is doing it. And since I started keeping track of this, Sam, in 2014, we were always doing 4 existing client deals and 1 new client deal. It was 4 and 1, 4 and 1, 4 and 1. In the last year, it's 4 and 2. For every 4 existing deals, we now get 2 brand new clients because of my marketing through the rookie training camp concept. And that's terrific.
Yeah, I'd say so. That's pretty impressive. Talk to us about things that you're seeing in the capital raise world. Like, what's it looking like right now?
First of all, there's all sorts of money. There's more money than there is properties. So the SEC, when you do a Reg D offering, you fill out a Form D and it goes to the SEC, and they use that for statistics. And every year in the end of March, they put out the statistics for the previous 12 months. And the statistics we're working with now are really still 2019. But the statistics said that there is $1.8 trillion raised in private placements.
Wow. Okay.
That's 7 times more than IPO money raised on the stock exchanges during the same year. This is where money is raised to promote businesses. And it's certainly not all real estate. Some statistics I've seen said that might be 30% real estate, but all sorts of business. Any small business who's looking to build, to grow and look for capital may not be able to go and borrow it. So they come into the private placement market. So that's $1.8 trillion. Now, 99% of that money is raised in Rule 506. 99% of that money, Reg D, Rule 506. $1.4 trillion in 506B, and we'll just talk about that briefly. 506B is what I write almost all of my documents in, and you can raise as much money as you want from as many accredited investors as you can find, 35 sophisticated investors, but you can't advertise. But that is raising $1.4 trillion of the $1.8 trillion. Mm. And about $210 billion is raised in the advertising world, 506C, where you can advertise, but then you can only take accredited investors. So that's where it is today. It's all Regulation D, Rule 506.
That's interesting. What, I mean, how much Reg A? Have you seen any?
Oh, not very much Reg A. There are $200 million maybe. Reg A has not been... Well, first of all, Reg A is extremely expensive to get a Reg A offering approved. It takes a lot of time. And once you get your, this isn't the right word, once you get your permit so you can sell your Reg A offering, who do you know to sell it to? I mean, there are a couple of places where it works. I've been the lead attorney in like 4 firms in the last 10 years because people are always coming and going. But in the firm right before the one I'm in now, we did Grant Cardone's Reg A offerings, Reg A Plus. And that's fine because he can go to Vegas, where we went last February with him, and he can stand on the podium on the stage at the Mandalay Bay Center with 12,000 people in the seats and pitch his Reg A Plus offering. And anyone there can invest.
Right.
We have someone right now we're working with who's trying to decide, and they have 80,000 subscribers to their YouTube channel. And their YouTube channel is designed to teach people how to invest in real estate. So there's a lot of people there who aren't sophisticated, who aren't accredited, who probably could come up with $5,000 and pitch it into a Reg A Plus fund. But it's not for everyone. If you don't have the built-in market to get started, yeah, you get a permit, but where do you go? So we really tell people, if you're going to do a Reg A Plus, you better be ready to commit $150,000 to $200,000 up front. Now, that's not all legal fees for sure, but that would include your marketing costs.
Right, right. Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that. Yeah, there's a lot, not just financial. There's time hurdles. And then also, to your point,
6 months.
Six months to get it done. And then, you know, to your point, like even once you get it done, you better have the investor or potential investor base to back it up so that you can fill it, because there's time restrictions on that too.
Sam, you got to have a plan. It's got to be a blind pool. If we're talking real estate,
right?
It's got to be a blind pool. Now, we did one 2 years ago for racehorses, and the plan was to go out and buy racehorses and train them and on and on. But for real estate, you know, you're not going to do a Reg A offering and the seller's going to sit there for 6 or 7 months waiting for you to do this. It's got to be a blind pool. So first of all, you better have a track record. So it's not for the faint of heart and it's not for the rookie. But what is interesting, going back to 506C where you can advertise, where not everyone is doing 506C because they don't think they need it. They have plenty of investors. More often than not, the people who come to me in my office to do a 506C are relatively new to the syndication world, and they might have done one deal, they might have done two, but they quickly find that their database isn't big enough. So they come and they do a 506C for one purpose, to market, to talk to new people, to get new people in their database so that in the future, they have new people with whom they have a pre-existing relationship. I mean, last year we did a 506C for a person who was only going to raise $500,000. And he had all the investors, all previous relationships. But he said, I'm gonna market this for 90 days on my website, and I think he added about 100 people to his database.
That's smart.
Good strategy.
Yeah, that's really smart. I like that. Especially if you already have the deal full, but you can still use it. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything more to do a 506B versus C. But then you can put all this out on your newsletters and on your Facebook pages and on LinkedIn and everywhere else.
Up until the first of the year, that caused a little bit of problem because there's this rule of integration that if you do two deals close together and the SEC audits you, the SEC will apply the most rigid set of rules to both deals. So if you do a 506C that says you can advertise, but everyone has to be accredited, and then you close that down and immediately come out with a 506B where you can't advertise, and the SEC sees that, the SEC is going to say, you know, that's all one deal. You advertise and you put people in your database, and the minute that you close this deal, you started this deal, and those people all came to you from advertising. And the rule was 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And recently, basically effective the first of the year, the rule is 30 days. Big difference. Close your Reg C and have all your documents ready for your 506B and
give it 30
open
days.
It up in 30 days and away we go.
Right. Second question for you on that. The definition of accredited investor has changed here in the last, I don't know when, 6 months, 5 months. I'm not sure when those.
December 8th. It's not turning out to be a big deal. First of all,
I didn't think so.
Stockbrokers who work in the securities world with certain securities licenses are going to be deemed accredited,
right,
regardless of their income. Makes some sense. I mean, they're already vetted with the FINRA and all that stuff, and they have a license. Why not? Okay. And then another one that's kind of interesting is the spousal equivalency. There are a lot of households in the United States where the two primary people aren't married. They live together, but they're not married. And the old rules of $1 million of net worth and $300,000 of income if you're married doesn't work. But now with spousal equivalency, the two people can combine their net worth to make it $1 million, and they can combine their income, even if they file individual tax returns, and they can combine their income to reach the $300,000 to qualify as accredited. That's good. You know, there are a lot of older people who live together who aren't married for one reason or another, and they live in the same household. you know, older women live together. It's a very interesting thing. That was good. And then I think the other thing that was, that is going to be important is that they clarified that if it's an entity coming to invest with you, like a family office or a company's 401k, where there are a lot of different investors, if the entity has $5 million in assets, we're just going to treat it as one investor and we're going to call it accredited.
Right.
Doesn't have $5 million in assets. You got to go through and look at each individual person to see if they're accredited or sophisticated. We never really had that clarity, but we do have that now. So I think that's going to be helpful. And I think the statistic I saw is there's like 13% of the households in the United States now are accredited, and it's about 16 million. So there's a lot of people out there to go and find, and not everyone wants to invest in real estate, but there's a lot of people out there to market to.
Right, right. And yeah, and that's interesting. And everything, you're confirming that everything I've read about the expanded accredited investor definition, it doesn't sound like it's going to have a big effect one way or the other.
No, the biggest effect on the accredited investor definition happened in Dodd-Frank when they removed the equity you had in your house from your net worth calculation. And the statistics I saw said that that took about one third of the accredited investors out of the game. And I don't think these changes are bringing back one third. One of the things that's interesting is I was in business when they came out in 1981 with the absolute dollar limits for accredited investors, because before that, there weren't any real limits. You could take rich and smart people, but you couldn't take sophisticated. So, but in 91 or 81, they came out and said, okay, here's what an accredited investor is, $1,200,300. And in order to promote capital formation, we'll let you take some smart people who maybe don't have those dollar and cent numbers. But that was 1981, when $1 million was something. Today, they're saying that, you know, if they just would have adjusted that for inflation all the way along, we'd probably be talking $2.5 million in net worth and $750,000 in married income. And they continue to refuse to change those numbers. But they do decide in this round that there's things other than your net worth and your income that make you smart enough, I guess, to understand the risks.
Yeah, and I'm in no favor, just to try to stay away from my views here on this show too much. But I see nothing but bad things coming out of putting restrictions on what people can and want to invest in. Because if they're smart enough and, you know, if they understand it, then I think it's on them. I see those regulations as doing nothing more than keeping people from getting involved in assets that, you know, could potentially make them wealthy. You can also lose money.
The best comment I ever heard on that, I was in Vegas teaching a class and someone spoke up and said that you didn't have to be an accredited investor to go to the craps table.
Exactly.
They let you figure that out yourself. I said, okay.
Exactly. Man, that's great. Gene, I have enjoyed this. I've learned a ton. This was way too short for me, as most of these podcasts are. But in light of the time, we've got to jump here into the final four.
Why don't we do this, Sam? Why don't you think about a specific issue and maybe in a couple months, call me up and I'll come back and we'll talk about something specific that we can really hone in on 15 or 20 minutes.
I would love that. I would love that. Look for that here in the future, listeners. You'll get our second round with Gene and I. And we'll and if you got something you want to hear, send me an email. Send me an email at sam@brickandinvestmentgroup.com and say, hey, I would love to ask this particular question to Gene on your next episode. Let me know that. Gene, the final four questions are this. What is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Build a team. This is not a do-it-yourself business. Provide continuity for the investors. We've had two sponsors die of COVID. Imagine how devastating that is. But our business practice is we won't write an offering for a syndication if the manager LLC doesn't have at least two people.
That's fascinating. I love that. Build a team. Second question is, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
Social media, my rookie class, my TLG talks, where I do like you do, where I interview people and put them on my YouTube. So it's all social media. How do I continue to stay in front of people, given the fact that I'm virtual in my home?
Right, right. No, that's great. That's great. When it comes to giving back, what is one way you are making the world a better place?
Mentoring, helping people who are trying to get started with advice that they need to get started.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. And if our listeners want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Well, my email address would be gene@trowbridgelawgroup.com, which you can see on the screen, and or the company phone numbers there. And that's it. Reach me through email or the company phone, and I'll get right back to you. And I'd be happy to talk to you. Free consultations. No one ever gets charged for an initial consultation.
That's awesome. And if you're just listening to this and not watching it, that number is 949-570-1507 in order to get a hold of Gene. Gene, thanks so much for coming on today. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.